Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hola, genies. Welcome to Extreme Jeans, Family History Radio and ExtremeJeans.com, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and I hope the search has been fruitful for you this past week. Who's been finding stuff? Well, at least a couple of people this past week have, and you'll hear from them both later in the show. In about 10 minutes, we'll talk to Phil Devitt, a newspaper editor in Fall River, Massachusetts. Phil's family has been in Fall River for generations, and he recently made the discovery of a particular journal that had belonged to his great-grandfather, a police officer for the town. What was in it, and where has it taken him? We will find out. And then later in the show, our friend Heath Jones is back. His group, Task Force History, has been at it again, searching the several hundred acres of property his family has owned in Alabama for over 150 years. Last time, he told us about the Civil War-era ring his team discovered. What have they literally dug up this time? Heath will have that story. If you have a great story of discovery, we'd love to hear from you. You can call our toll-free find line at 1-2-3-4-5-6-GENES, G-E-N-E-S. Tell us your story, ask your question, leave your comment, and we'll be happy to get back to you. Concerning Blaine Bettinger's recent comments on why not to blame DNA companies for family secrets being revealed through DNA testing, Luann in Fort Myers, Florida commented, "Fisher, Blaine is right. Secrets can come from all kinds of stuff, not just DNA. I recently met a half-sister I never knew I had, and I'm 76 years old. She found me after her adoption papers were opened, and we learned we shared the same mother. No DNA necessary. No one was more surprised about this discovery than my mom. She gave up my sister when she was 18. She's now 98 years old. If you don't want to know family secrets, stay out of this business. Every family has them. Luann, all I can say is, wow. If you missed my visit with Blaine, you can always catch the podcast at ExtremeJeans.com on iTunes or iHeartRadio's new talk channel. And you can listen on your mobile device by downloading our free app for iPhones and Android. Just look for Extreme Jeans in your phone's app store. And by the way, you can email me at Fisher@ExtremeJeans.com or you can drop me a note through our Facebook page at Facebook.com/ExtremeJeans. Hey, and while you're there, please give us a like. We'd love to have you as part of our growing family of Extreme Jeans followers. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeJeans.com. Heidi Mitchell at Yahoo.com has written an article on what she calls heritage travel. She opens by saying, most Americans, let's face it, are mutts. She writes about a New Yorker named Laura Galloway, who took a business trip to Sweden 3 years ago and found people who looked just like her. With almond-shaped eyes and snow-white hair, she immediately felt a deep-down connection and returned to the U.S. and immediately sent her DNA sample in to 23andMe, who confirmed she was half Sami, believed to be Northern Europe's earliest indigenous people. Galloway was so intrigued by her heritage that she made numerous return visits, learning the Sami language and how to herd reindeer. Honest. The article discusses how the European travel industry is now prepared for people like Laura and us with, for example, professional genealogists hired full-time in hotels, particularly in Scotland. They report that almost $4 billion in revenue is expected to come from heritage travel in Scotland alone in 2014. You might get some ideas for your own heritage travel by reading the entire article through the link at ExtremeJeans.com. NBCNews.com has an article about a current feature at the New York Historical Society Museum and Library in Manhattan called the Chinese American Exclusion Inclusion Exhibit. The story is written by Michelle Lee, who talks about how little her heritage was discussed in history classes in school growing up in New York. But now the story of her family is available for anyone to see at this unique exhibit. It covers three generations of the Lee family in America, with photos and artifacts, many displayed in glass cases. Included in the exhibition were artifacts such as a 1913 photograph of Michelle's great-grandfather with his certificate of identity. Every Chinese American was required to have this document on them at all times. Otherwise, even as an American, They could have been sent back to China. Another panel featured her great uncle, who died as a member of the U.S. Army in Africa in World War II in 1944. His ID tag and the contents of the wallet he was carrying when he was killed are part of the presentation. Michelle discusses Chinese-American involvement in the history of our country, including the story of Wong Kim Ark, a cook. It was his case, taken up by the Supreme Court in 1898, that made it law that anyone born in America is a United States citizen. There's also a recreation of Angel Island and Ellis Island of the West. How many of us have heard of that? It's a fascinating article with some great pictures. Find the link now at extremejeans.com. And coming up next, he was covering a ceremony for the induction of new policemen into the force in a town in Massachusetts. That led to newspaper editor Phil Devitt looking through a very special book. Phil will tell us about where that led him and the connection he's since made with an ancestor he never met who walked the same streets he walks every day. That's in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show.
Hey, you have found us, Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with my guest, the editor from Falls River, Massachusetts, Phil Devitt. How are you, Phil? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm doing just fine.
And, you know, the reason we're in touch is because Phil has located, I would guess you'd call it a log or a journal of your great-grandfather. This is the thing. You get something like that in the hands of a writer, suddenly all that information is out there for everybody to see, and I got a kick out of reading what you've written here in your newspaper. What is it, South Coast Today?
Yeah, we're South Coast Media Group in southeastern Massachusetts, and one of the cities we cover is Fall River, and that's my city that I report on. And I had been chomping at the bit to write about this notebook for a long time, and the timing felt right just recently.
Now, where did you get the notebook?
Well, this is really an example of finding something that has been under your nose the whole time, you know, right in
yes.
front of you, which I think a lot of people in this community can relate to. This notebook has been in my family for about a century now, but it was never in a glass case or on the fireplace mantle or something that we talked about all that much.
Yeah, they rarely are.
Right. So while I knew it existed, that sort of floated to the nether regions of my brain, and I forgot as I grew up that we had it. But since I'm reporting about Fall River, I found myself at a swearing-in ceremony for 15 new police officers last year. And before the officers were sworn in, the police chief came to the podium and said, "We have a department tradition dating back to the early 19th century, and that is that any new officer, before swearing the oath, comes up and signs his name in this book." And that triggered something in me. I said, "Wait, my great-grandfather, who I didn't know all that much about, was a Fall River police officer." So after the ceremony, I went over to the ledger and I found his name there, and I was just confronted with my family's past. It was great. It was great to see. It was and so well preserved, so well taken care of. It looked like the ink had just dried.
Right, right. The sacred book.
The sacred book. And so I said, "That's right, the notebook. I've seen that handwriting before in my youth. I know we have that notebook somewhere." And I went home and found it and dug it out. And
now, did you have it? Your parents have it? What was the story?
My parents had it. My father, so it has been in his possession for some time, passed down to him through the generations. And so I knew to go to him to look for it. And when I found it, I didn't want to put it down.
Oh, I bet. Did he let you take it?
He let me take it. He trusts me, as far as I can tell. You know, he didn't think I was going to put it on eBay or anything.
Right, right.
So, and I understood. I think he and I have a mutual appreciation for how precious those documents are, because this is really the only thing I know of that the family has of my great-grandfather remaining.
Sure.
So we knew that whatever's in there is going to tell us a lot about him and who he was and how he worked. And it's true. I get to, every time I pick it up, spend a year working with my grandfather on the same streets that I report about now. So
isn't that interesting? And, you know, yeah. It really does extend the taproot, doesn't it? I mean, your sense of your life extending way back before you were even born.
It does. You know, you hear the names when you grow up, and occasionally you'll hear a story or two. But there's really something about having something tactile in your hands that you can just connect with somebody about. I can, every time I pick it up, I can picture him walking down the street and jotting down names and information in there. And I feel like I'm with him in a way. It's the closest thing we have to time travel as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and I was looking at some of the entries because these are from mostly the early 1920s. And I was thinking about how I've read where school teachers back in the 1940s, one of the biggest issues they had in dealing with the students was that they would chew gum during class.
And oh, boy.
Yes, I know. It doesn't get much worse than that. But when you read your stuff, it's kind of similar, isn't it? You know, the officer on the beat and what's he looking for. Let's go through some of these entries.
Sure. When I read the book for the first time all the way through, I had to stop and think, and I mentioned this in the story. I had to wonder if the police chief put my great-grandfather on the meddling kids beat. Because every other page is an entry about kids misbehaving, and some of these are kind of a hoot. Let's go to Monday, June 13th, 1921.
Okay.
And he says, patrolled Route 22 from 6 to 1 a.m. and found six boys trespassing and damaging flowers on grave lots in the North Burial Ground.
Mm.
And an hour later, he found five young boys trespassing at St. John's Cemetery, and he secured their names. No idea if the boys found in the last cemetery are the boys found in the first cemetery, but
right,
you know, you're led to believe that they may know each other at the very least.
Well, and it's interesting because you guys both grew up in the same town. You grew up in Fall River, yes?
I did, yeah. My roots are right there in the city. So when I read about, you know, the North Burial Ground or French Street or Highland Avenue, these are all streets that I can walk down today and I can appreciate it and see the same houses he visited. It's great that way. This is one of my favorites, and there's a happy ending to this one, which you don't often see in these very quick, terse reports. It's about a bunch of kids on April 28th, 1921, at the baseball field. They damaged a bicycle owned by another young man named George Kimball.
Uh-oh.
Yep, and the damage was estimated at a whopping $7.85.
Mm-hmm.
So then my great-grandfather lists the names and addresses of the accused and says that the boys admit causing the damage to the bicycle, and they agreed to pay the bill and bring the receipt to the station house to show that it was settled, because that would be satisfactory to George Kimball, the young boy who owned the bicycle.
See, that's an awesome entry, and you've got some names there. My question is, do those family names ring familiar to you? Did you grow up with their grandchildren?
Well, you know, these names in particular don't ring a bell, but it's very interesting. After I published this story, I got an email from a woman who lives in California now who happens to be a Fall River native, and she was wondering if I could go through the book and find any of her relatives, and she listed them for me. So I haven't gotten back to her yet, but I kind of want to tell her, you know, I'll look, but if your relatives are in this book, it's probably because they were doing something bad.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look for that. It's just a lot of fun. It's opened up a lot of fun for me, which I didn't expect.
And it connects you to him. And that's the thing that's so interesting. Suddenly, these people become very real and not just a name on a tombstone or, a name in family lore. You're holding something that was theirs. So how many names do you think you have in there? Have you gone through and actually started to index it?
I haven't indexed it yet. If I had to estimate, there's a name in almost every entry, and there are entries for almost all 365 days between January of 1921 and January of 1922. So I would estimate we have, at the very least, a couple of hundred names. And it would be very interesting to go in and now see if we can make connections in modern day to the people mentioned in the book.
Well, you might have a centenarian or something out there who's still living who was mentioned in there as a child.
Yeah, you know, that's very true. People are living a lot longer now. And if not, certainly family members who would love to get their hands on this and know more about their own relatives and what they were up to on, you know, August 3rd, 1921, whether it was good or bad. And you're right. I don't know about anybody else, but I have the tendency to romanticize the past since I wasn't there. You know,
it's a lot of fun. Absolutely.
Yeah, but sometimes you can look at things as hunky-dory and black and white and everything was fine. So it was refreshing to go into this notebook and to see how similar, in some respects, my great-grandfather's time was to today. It wasn't Mayberry by any stretch of the imagination. There are references to assault and battery and attempted robbery and theft and traffic violations and, of course, kids being kids.
Mm-hmm.
And while all of that sounds pretty ugly, there is something, I don't know, beautiful in that, and being able to connect with that time and say, gee, you know, we're really not that different.
No, that's true. I mean, it's just the way we go about living because of technology and things like that. I was looking at this one entry from 1921, and your great-grandfather, Patrick, nabbed a speed demon, patrolled Route 22 and 23 from 1 a.m. to 8 a.m., investigated vile auto law on Brightman Street by Joseph Raposa of 6th Stewart Street, traveled west at 40 to 45 miles an hour on Brightman.
Right. I think today, if you traveled 40 to 45 miles on Brighton, nobody would bat an eye. In fact, you might get people honking at you because you're going too slow.
Yes. And he got a $20 ticket for going 40.
He got a $20 ticket for going 40. And if I'm not mistaken, Joseph Raposa is mentioned a few other times in the book for other auto violations. So I can't really say he learned his lesson, at least not in the early 1920s.
Sounds like a Leadfoot.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to look out for these people.
As a writer, you might want to start gathering some of the descendants of these folks together and have a day where you go through it all together about which one of their relatives, which one of their ancestors did what in Fall River.
I think that is a fantastic idea. We certainly, that's right up our alley here, and on a personal level, that would be entertaining to no end.
Oh, yeah, and you could write a great story, I think, that might get some attention, too.
Absolutely. It's amazing the attention that this one has gotten. You know, I mentioned a woman from California who connected with it, but I got an email from a woman who lives maybe three or four blocks away from me, and she said, I read your story. I think we are related. And I wrote back to her, and we ended up exchanging a few names and cross-checking, and sure enough, we are cousins, maybe two or three times removed. But here's a woman I had never met in my life who lives in the same neighborhood, who has an entire family history written and bound that she plans to give me a copy of soon. This has opened up a whole Pandora's box in a good way for me.
You're on your way to an amazing adventure.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I feel almost like I was pushed by unseen forces to look into this and get started and launch off on my own journey to discover who did what in my family and when they got here and what their lives were like. And it's going to be incredible, I think.
Phil Devitt, thanks so much for your time and congratulations on your discoveries and good luck in your journey.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And on the way in 5 minutes, our friends at Task Force History in Heflin, Alabama are back at it. What have they found now? Our friend Heath Jones will tell us about the renewed search for ancestral artifacts on his own family's longtime property when we return in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back. It is Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the radio root sleuth, with my good friend Heath Jones on the line from Alabama once again with Task Force History. Heath, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Fisher.
Yeah, I love this because a few months ago we had you on with some of your buddies, and you're one of the rare people who can actually go do family history research on a piece of property that's been in your family for how long?
Well, since about the 1850s. We've had it in our family, and it's been passed down. We have part that's still part of the old original plantation.
Unbelievable. And you found on that property, as I recall, or one of your teammates found, an old ring that dated back to the Civil War era, which you presented or he presented to your grandmother, who is, 90 years old or something. I mean, just it was an unbelievable find because she knew it had belonged to one of her family members.
Yes, sir. It was a great find. She doesn't have a lot of her family left, and most of her family died when she was very young. So it was very special to her, and Brian is just a stand-up guy, and we really appreciate him doing that.
And now you've gone back out onto this property. I keep thinking to myself, if I had a piece of property that was in my family a century and a half or longer, I mean, to go out there with metal detectors and mapping out certain areas and digging where foundations were and the things you might find relating to yourself are unbelievable. And the reason we're talking now is you have found some more things. Fill us in on this.
Sure. Yeah, we had a big hunt. I had about 70 people, my closest friends, and people affiliated with Task Force History and customers of mine that had purchased metal detectors from me. They come out, and we found a lot of great items out there this past week, or 2 weekends ago now.
Now, what is it you do? Now, you arrange this thing and you got all these people. Do you actually grid out certain places, or do you go with shovels, or do you do it just with the metal detectors? How do you work?
Well, typically we will grid out an area when we want to make sure that we cover everything. And we'll do the grid so that each person's overlapping. This past hunt, though, we just kind of put everybody out freestyling. We camped out and cooked and everything for everybody. And just, you know, everybody kind of find their own spot. And, you know, believe it or not, we actually had a lot of great finds that resulted in that, even though we didn't grid out the area.
How big a property is it, first of all?
We've got about 300 acres left. At one time, we had 1,000, and it's just kind of dwindled down as people have passed on and the properties passed down through
sure.
You know, siblings and that sort of thing.
Now, so the property you have is where the homestead was, though?
It is not where the plantation was. The part that I have was where my grandmother was born, and they owned that, or they moved into that property around 1910.
Okay. So what have you found in this latest effort?
Well, a good friend of mine, that's also a member, J.C. Carbajal from Birmingham, she come up and she found a Union bullet that had been fired. It's commonly called a three-ringer.
Right. I'm familiar with them. Your area, though, was there fighting going on there?
No, and that's what's so rare about it. We really couldn't believe it. You know, this is the first one that's ever been found. And also found a small musket ball, like a pistol round, as well, a 36 caliber. So we're going to have to do a lot of research and try to figure out. I don't know where that come from, but we found a lot of other items. One of my friends from Tennessee, Jennifer Burrell, she located a half dime, 1850s. We can't make out the exact date, but we can tell it's 1850s, see that half dime.
Right, the half dimes date back to that era, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And then they changed in the 1860s, if I recall.
I believe so. And you know, we don't find a lot of coins from the 1860s, or at least we haven't so far, because during the Civil War, there wasn't that many coins
right.
from the U.S. down during the Civil War. So
yeah, that makes sense. So you'd either find them from before or after.
Sure. Most of the coins we found out there have been in the 1850s. Brian Romine, that found the ring, he actually found an 1853 seated dime. There at that same location, not far from where he found the ring, believe it or not.
Now, is this, if you're finding rings and coins, it kind of suggests that somebody might have lived on the spot that he's looking at. Are you aware of a former structure there?
Yes, there. We found rocks and that sort of thing, and then there's an old well close by. So we know that there was somebody living there, and that's where my grandmother's aunt lived, and that's why we believe that that ring also belonged to them.
Mm-hmm. How many people did you have on this?
We had about 70 people all told during the weekend. We had some people come in early Friday. They camped out. And then we had the main hunt was Saturday, and then we had more people even come in on Sunday. So it was just a great time.
Well, and with 300 acres, I mean, you could do this for the rest of your life, couldn't you?
Oh, sure. And, you know, that's why, you know, I don't charge anybody to come hunt or anything like that. There's a lot of land, and I just want to make it accessible to people that want to learn about history and are interested in that sort of thing.
Now, do they take these items and return them to you because they're part of your family? Is that part of the requirement?
No, it's not. I don't require anybody to give these items back. If, like the coins, they both took the coins home with them. They offered to give them back, but you know, I'm not going to take stuff like that. The only thing that we really kind of wanted was that ring, and even then, we weren't going to take that, but Brian was nice enough to offer it to my grandmother, and that
right.
meant a lot.
Absolutely. So how many years have you been doing this with Task Force History?
Well, Task Force History just started a couple of years ago. We actually had another name, and it's a really long name. It's hard to pronounce. We called it AAHS for the abbreviation, and that's about as much as we'll go into.
And so how many items over the years have you found? I mean, the ring made national news, but now you're finding more stuff. How much have you found over the last couple of years since you started this?
Well, we found several things on the property. We found several seated dimes, half dimes, jewelry. My friend Mike Roper, he found a locket. We're still trying to get that dated. We don't know if it's going to be Depression era or earlier, but it's a cool little locket, you know. And unfortunately, there wasn't a picture in there. We were kind of hoping.
Yeah, I was wondering who would be
yeah.
in there. Any initials on it?
No, I'm going to get you a picture, and if you guys want to put it up on your page, you'd be glad to.
Oh, yeah. Love to see that.
Let the listeners see it. maybe somebody will be able to tell us what time period it dates from. So,
yeah, absolutely. Were there people living there during the Depression?
There were. There were actually people living on the property until 1972, when the last home place, the home that my grandmother was born in, when it burned.
Wow, you might be able to find a black and white TV there then somewhere.
Well, you know, if everything hadn't burned, it was a three-story home, and everything kind of burned and collapsed in on itself. So we're still finding stuff actually, you know, in the rubble of that home.
How fun is that? So what's on your agenda? Where are you going next? Because I know you don't just work on your own land, which to me is the most intriguing thing, because family history is so fun to think, wow, I could find items that my people actually owned.
Well, you know, Fisher, we do a lot of projects. We have people call us and want us to investigate their land. We've got information about two Civil War cannons that are in a river. We're researching those. We have divers on our team. We're going to send them down and get a look at them. And, of course, we're going to work with a state archaeologist on that and make sure that it's excavated correctly. That's on the agenda. We've been to several Confederate camps along the way that we're going to be researching. We've got a lot of stuff going on. We've actually even just done home sites for other people. We did a home site for a group for a lady in Birmingham, and we found a 1888, I believe it was, a police belt buckle there.
Wow.
And the girl that found the belt buckle, her father was actually the former police chief in that area, not that far back, but they then donated the belt buckle to the National Police Museum. That was really cool. The belt buckle online appraised for about $300. And for them to donate that was really nice of them.
Very kind. Well, a lot of fun. I'm always happy to hear about what you guys are doing, because it sounds like something I'd actually like to be joining you on sometime. So maybe
you
know, I will.
We'd love to have you out on one of our digs, and make sure on the next dig we'll get you an invite to it.
All right, buddy. Well, you take care of yourself. Thanks for checking in.
All right. Thanks for having us on again.
And by the way, that locket that Heath described can be seen on our website, extremejeans.com, as well as our Facebook page. It's pretty awesome. Check it out. Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority, is next. He's going to be answering another one of your questions when we return in 3 minutes on Extreme Jeans Family History Radio and extremejeans.com. Welcome back to Extreme Jeans Family History Radio, extremejeans.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry. He is our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Welcome back, Tom.
It's good to be back.
And we have a question for you from Ruth Springer in West Jordan, Utah. She writes to you, of course, at AskTom@TMCPlace.com and says, Tom, is there any way to fix a warped disc? Ooh, that sounds awful.
That is really awful. You know, there's a lot of different things that you can try. It depends how warped it is. I've even had people bring ones into us that were just a little warped, and we put them in our duplicator and set it at the slowest speed, a one-time speed, 1X as they call it, and we're able to duplicate it, and so it worked fine. That's kind of rare. If you're in the situation where you're willing to take a gamble and try something, and if you lose a disc, it doesn't matter because it's so warped anyway, what you can do is get two pieces of wood, a good hardwood like a walnut, make sure it's really, really smooth. Put your disc between those two layers of the wood. Preheat your oven to only 100 degrees. Put the disc in there with the wood on both sides and leave it in there for only about 10 minutes. Then once it's at 10 minutes, turn the oven off, but don't take it out. Leave it in there and let it just naturally cool. It could take an hour, could take a couple of hours.
Just 100 degrees?
Oh, yeah, just 100 degrees. Oh, yeah, that's when they will start getting in the set that they'll start melting. Same thing like in your cars. And every oven vary a little bit, whether you have like a toaster oven or a big oven. I'd probably use a toaster oven. And it just depends on the consistency of the heat. If you try that and it didn't work, go a little bit hotter. But you don't want to start too big and have the thing melt, because then once you damage the plastic part, if it's a replicated disc, which means you bought a disc at a store like a Disney DVD that has the stuff actually ingrained right into it, you could damage those. The biggest thing with a one-off disc, like the kind you make at home that have dye in them, is the silver, if it gets too hot, it can crack. And once that happens, the disc is pretty much gone. So that's an option. What I would do, one of these days I'm going to actually try this. We do a lot of baking of tapes, old reel-to-reel tapes, videotapes that have lost their...
Yeah, they start to flake.
Yeah, they flake. So the way we deflake them, so to speak, is we actually heat them, but we heat them in a food dryer because it's slower constant heat. You could try that if you try the oven way, it doesn't work, or try this if you got a good food dehydrator. Do the same thing with the blocks of wood, put it in there, but you know, probably leave it at least a day and just check on it from time to time because it's less heat, but it's consistent heat.
Now, you're talking about if the disc is not severely warped, it's just
right.
somewhat bent.
Right. If okay. it's really bad, if it's really rippled, do the oven thing, and I would go a higher temperature, maybe 150, 200 degrees. I'm just talking about barely warped ones. If they're
sure.
really warped, even the compression of bringing them down, even if you get them warm enough, the chance of it surviving is zero. However, if it's a disc you don't care about, go ahead and do it. And if you have a disc like this and you don't want to take your own chance, send it in to us. We'll experiment with it and see what happens. And if we're able to recover it, dynamite, and you know we can tell other people on the air what's happened. So if you have one, you don't want to do it yourself, send it in to us. Write me at asktom@tmcplace.com. And we'll take care of it, and maybe we can get something done for you.
So what causes a disc to warp?
Usually 9 out of 10 times, it's heat. So you're just undoing it from the heat. The thing is, I see people all the time, they throw a CD on the top of their dashboard as they put a new CD in their player, and they forget about it. And it might only get to 70 degrees outside, but if that's on your front window, that's going to become like a magnifying glass, and it's going to warp. I've seen videotapes, audio cassettes, CDs, DVDs, everything just totally warped beyond recognition by just sitting them on your dashboard.
All right. Family history gives you some great opportunities for gifts that people will never forget.
The first one I'm going to tell you about, it's fairly simple that anyone can do, and it takes very minimal effort. All you need to do is go to a local bookstore on Amazon.com, buy an age-appropriate book for one of your grandkids or your own kids. And then what you want to do is you want to get an audio recorder, like they have these new digital ones, or a lot of computers. You can just hook a mic into it and then read the book onto your computer, whatever, make an AIFF file or an MP3 file. And then you burn this to a CD and you give it to your kid with the book or your grandkid or great grandkid. And just think how exciting it would have been if your parents, your grandparents had done this for you. They're a lot of fun to do. There's a lot of Dr. Seuss books. There's Disney books. There's so many different books out there, just light stuff that the kids will enjoy. If you have older kids that love to read and love to go to the library and check out books on tape, get maybe a small novel or something like that as well, and just read it to them and then give them the book with a CD. And this is something that is so priceless that can be handed down for generations and generations. One day, your grandkids or parents, and they're talking about their grandparents, they can go and give them this book, make a copy of it, get the CD and play it for them. And it's something, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
And it could be even better if they're reading their own family history, their own story.
Okay, you just stole the thunder. I was going to say the second tip is even better than the first tip, and that's exactly what it is. You go get your family history, of your own personal family history, and read into the microphone, make the MP3 or the AIFF file, whichever you want. Now, some people say, well, what's the difference between MP3s and AIFFs? AIFFs are basically what a CD is that you play in your car in a normal CD player. Of course, we know MP3 are for like iPads, iPods, different things like that. And a lot of the older cars, you can't play MP3s in them. A lot of the newer cars, you can. So if you're really good at the computer, you can go and make both. Record the thing, make the AIFF CD to play in the car. So on a traveling trip, they can hear grandma telling stories or reading stories or reading a novel or anything. But it's wonderful. But as you mentioned, it's even better when it's your own story. And if you say, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. My life's not important. I don't know what to talk about. I don't know where to begin. There's two books that I recommend. There's tons out there, but there's two I recommend. The one is called The Book of Myself. It's a do-it-yourself autobiography. It has 201 questions, and it's written by Carl and David Marshall, and it's only like $15.95 retail. I'm sure it's cheaper on Amazon. Another book that's really good is The Book of Me by Nanette Stone, which is only $14.99.
Right, and these give you questions to ask yourself or actually to write on and expound on and maybe create an entire chapter around.
You know, even have your kids do stuff like this. Have them go and read their own questions. Have them tell these stories. Play it on your next travel vacation. And you're going to learn stuff about your kids you had no idea. Oh, that's their favorite color. Oh, this is what their dreams are. So it's not like, oh, this is just for old people to do for their kids. Even younger kids that can't even read, read them questions and see what their responses are. And these CDs that you're going to make are going to be priceless. They're going to be absolutely incredible for you to enjoy, for generations to enjoy in the future.
Well, those are great suggestions. Thanks so much, Tom. And if you have a question for Tom, you can always ask Tom at tmcplace.com. Thanks once again to Phil Devitt from Fall River, Massachusetts, for sharing his story of discovery of his great-grandfather's police journal. And our friends in Alabama, Heath Jones and Task Force History, with the update on their recent discoveries on his family land. Next week, we're going to get caught up on the world's largest family reunion. How are the plans coming for next year's big event in New York? We'll be talking to AJ Jacobs. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family's story by going to FamilySearch.org.